From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
As the parliamentary session nears the winter recess, Labor has found itself on the spot. A speech by frontbencher Anthony Albanese last week has been seen as his positioning in case things go really badly for Labor at the Super Saturday by-elections in late July. Then Bill Shorten's sudden announcement that Labor would repeal company tax cuts for businesses between 10 and 50 million turnover has brought a storm of criticism from the business sector. Today we're talking with Tanya Plibersek, Labor's deputy leader, who is also the opposition's spokeswoman on education. Tanya Plibersek, we'll get to education in a few minutes, but first, the general political scene in your role as Labor deputy. I did rather like your observation on Saturday that you hadn't yet read Anthony Albanese's Friday night speech because you'd been at the gym and you'd been buying the groceries. It's nice to see a politician who actually has a life. But you've read it now, and what are your thoughts on it?
Look, I'm not quite sure what the fuss is about. It seems to me to be a speech that covers a lot of things that the Labor Party's been saying for a long time. I don't see anything in there that I would see as remarkable or controversial in any way.
Has he got a point about the need for Labor to have a better relationship with the business community?
Well, I think for the most part we've got a very good relationship with the business community. We don't happen to agree with the government that they need an $80 billion big business tax cut right now, given all of the other pressures on the budget. We would always prioritise health and education and making sure that people on low and middle incomes are getting higher wages and better tax relief at that low and middle income area. So I don't think saying no to big business tax cuts that include, for example, a $17 billion tax cut for the big banks over the next decade means we're anti-business. It just means we're prudent economic managers.
Business has been pretty critical, though, in particular of this plan to roll back a large part of the already legislated tax cuts for smaller businesses.
Well, look, I'm sure that if you ask a person whether they would like a tax cut, or if you ask a business whether they'd like a tax cut, the answer's almost always going to be yes. We need to make a decision that's in the national interest, however. I think it's quite extraordinary that when we ask the government, if there is another global financial crisis, will you proceed with the later stages of the personal income tax cuts? Will you commit to the full package of the business tax cuts, including tax cuts for very, very large corporations? They insist that, yes, they will go ahead. Now, this is a government that has already doubled the deficit. Gross debt is crashing through $500 billion. The debt and deficit situation is already serious. They've cut $17 billion from schools, billions of dollars from hospital, about $3 billion from TAFE and training and apprenticeships, aged care, childcare. We've got about 280,000 people, families that will be worse off. I mean, there are some very important priorities for us as a nation that the government is choosing not to fund at the same time as they're giving these tax cuts, and they're doing it without identifying any offsets. They're saying, oh, it'll be fine, it'll be good for the economy, you know, just trust us. If Labor made a $143 billion announcement about personal income tax cuts and an $80 billion announcements about company tax cuts without saying how we were going to pay for it, I think people would be scandalised, but that's what this government's getting away with right now.
Bill Shorten announced almost off the cuff, it seemed, this week, the plan to roll back the tax cuts for companies with annual turnovers between 10 million and 50 million. Did you know that that announcement was going to come on Tuesday morning?
Well, we've had a lot of discussions, as you can imagine, about the company tax proposals, and I don't think the degree of surprise that the government is feigning is really quite justified. I mean, we've said all along, we support company tax cuts for companies up to $2 million. We've said all along that we are very critical of the tax cuts at the upper end for companies with very large turnovers. I'm a bit surprised at the kind of colour and light around this at the moment.
But shouldn't the announcement have been better framed?
Well, we're still looking at what we do for those companies at the lower turnover end, but
this
above
$2
million.
This is between $2 million and $10
million. Yeah, and I mean, look, it came as no surprise to me. So I guess I'm a bit surprised by the degree of attention it's received.
The Treasurer today quoted you as saying last year that, and I quote, "We've said that we support tax cuts up to $2 million, but beyond that, we really can't afford them at the moment." Do you stand by that?
Well, we've said all along that we support tax cuts for companies with turnovers up to $2 million. We said that from the very beginning. And beyond that, we've said we will consider what else we do. Now, we haven't landed on the, final decision about those companies at the lower end, but we have said all along our priority will be proper funding for health, proper funding for education, making sure that we are able to give bigger tax cuts to people on low and middle incomes. For example, a teacher on $65,000 a year is $928 better off with Labor's tax cuts than they otherwise would be. We know that that makes a big difference if we're investing our tax cuts at that low and middle income end. We see greater activity in the economy because people on low and middle incomes are much more likely to go and spend the tax cuts that we're giving them. We've made our priorities clear all along, and I don't think there's any surprises there.
But don't you think it's important now to clarify this position for these companies who are at the moment in limbo about your policy? Sure. Shouldn't this be sorted out soon?
Yeah, we will. We'll take our time. We'll do our work as we always do, and we'll make a final announcement sometime soon.
Now, turning to the by-elections, have you been campaigning in Longman and Braddon? And what's your impression now of how Labor is going in each of these seats?
Well, I have been, you will be unsurprised to know, Michelle, campaigning in both Braddon and Longman, and I'm off to Western Australia soon. My certain knowledge is we have both the better candidates and the better policies in both of
the candidates. But do you have the more votes?
Well, it's a tough contest. I mean, both Braddon and Longman are very marginal seats, as you know, seats that we took from the Liberals at the last election. They were tough campaigns then. We're having, very strong fights on the ground at the moment, making sure that everybody in those seats knows that under Labor, everybody up to $125,000 a year gets a bigger tax cut under Labor, plus we can afford to invest in their schools, in their TAFE, in their hospitals, in their health services, because we're not giving away tax cuts to people on very high incomes and big multinational companies so that 60% of the benefit goes to overseas shareholders. We prioritise ordinary families in seats like Braddon and Longman ahead of the big end of town. We're making that very clear in our campaigning.
Bill Shorten said the other day in caucus that Braddon was very difficult. Is that your assessment?
It's tough. It's always been a tough seat for us. We're very lucky that we've got Justine Kay, a fantastic candidate, who's just working her socks off. She's really very focused, hardworking local member. She has really made an impression in her very little time so far as the sitting member. I very much think the people of Braddon will respond well to Labor's message, but it's a tough seat. We can only do the best campaigning we can do.
If Labor lost both these seats, would there be questions about Bill Shorten's leadership?
Well, we're not contemplating that. as I say, we've got the best candidates with the best policies, and our whole focus right now is on winning those seats, on winning the Western Australian seats as well, and we're giving it a red-hot go in Mayo as well. I think the real loser here is already Malcolm Turnbull. I mean, fancy not running a candidate in Fremantle and Perth. And Fremantle and Perth, Perth in particular, is a seat that has a quite high Liberal primary vote and has had a quite high Liberal primary vote in past elections. I think it's extraordinary that the Liberals have completely vacated the field in these seats already. So, and I'd say the only loser so far is Malcolm Turnbull.
Well, talking about Western Australia, this week Madeleine King from that state has taken the front bench vacancy that's come up because she ticked a number of boxes, multiple boxes, not just gender, but factional and state ones as well. Now, this has left the well-qualified Christina Keneally still on the back bench. Do you think that Labor really has become a bit crazy about quotas of various sorts?
Well, I think Madeleine King will make an excellent contribution on the front bench. She is very bright, very hardworking, with a lot of very valuable life experience to bring to the
Keneally
role on the front
bench.
But
Keneally is very experienced.
She is. And I don't doubt for a moment that Christina Keneally, with her experience and her talent, will be on Labor's front bench sometime in the not-too-distant future. And we're very lucky to have so many talented people to choose from.
But surely it is true, leaving aside the question of the women, that when you get to a situation that you've got to be from a small state or a sub-faction, that it does become a bit of a constriction on using the best people.
Look, we've got a lot of talented people, but we also want to make sure that different parts of the country are represented, that we're not choosing, you know, only people who live in Sydney or Melbourne. So I think it is important to think about the way we make good decisions. We make good decisions where we have a variety of people, different ages, different life experiences, gender balance, different backgrounds, professional backgrounds, and some coverage of the country as well. We want to make sure that we have regional perspectives, that we have, you know, inner city perspectives. It helps us make better decisions if we have a more diverse front bench, and it is worth thinking about that when we're choosing people. I'm particularly proud of the fact that, not just in the front bench, but looking across Labor's parliamentary representation now, we are at almost 50% women. And the reason we're at almost 50% women is because we set a target, and it is important. You know, I'm sure that that there are very talented men who might have been disappointed this time round. But if we value diversity, then it is important to set targets and stick to them. You look at the Liberals, they've got 20%, about 20% women in their caucus. We've got almost 50%. Mm. We started at around about the same level in 1994 when Labor set its first gender targets. We started around the same level, and we're at almost half, and they're at 1 in 5. Targets work.
Now, turning to education, your portfolio area, Labor says, as we know, that it would spend more money on schools. But would it also make some special arrangements for the Catholic sector, which has been particularly unhappy with the government's plan?
Well, Simon Birmingham has done the incredible. He's actually managed to unite public school advocates, Catholic schools and independent schools against his education funding policies for the first time. I mean, some governments have managed to disappoint or enrage one sector or the other. It's a pretty rare policy that manages to enrage all three sectors. We've said that we'll restore all of the $17 billion cut from schools. We absolutely have said to the Catholic sector that we'll restore the funding cuts that have been made to them over the next 2 years. But the biggest restoration will obviously be to public schools, because it's public schools that have seen the biggest cuts. About 86% of the cuts over the 2 years that represent the final 2 years of the original Gonski needs-based funding package. About 86% of the cuts came from public schools, so it'll be public schools that are the biggest beneficiaries when we restore the funding.
The government is presently working to pass legislation to lower the HECS repayment threshold to $45,000. Labor's opposing this. What are your objections? Isn't some lower threshold reasonable?
$45,000 is too low, though. And you think about people who are just finishing university, many of them students who've gone to university straight after school, they're moving out of home at the same time, perhaps they're starting a family. We think $45,000 is too low a threshold to be expecting people to start to repay their HECS debt. It is pretty extraordinary that the Prime Minister wants someone on $45,000 a year to be paying, say, $450 a year more, and wants someone on $180,000 a year to get a tax cut. So we think the balance is wrong. Australia is already one of the countries in the OECD that has student contributions at the higher end. I think we're about the sixth highest in the OECD for student contribution. And to start that, repayment at such a relatively lower wage, I think is very hard on people just starting out in life.
Unpaid education debt's now risen to something like $54 billion, with about a quarter of people never repaying their debt. What would a Labor government do about this?
Well, one of the reasons that debts are higher is because the cost of the courses has increased so much over the years. So we certainly wouldn't agree to the government's proposal of $100,000 university degrees. We do think it is important to work with students to lower the amount, and in fact we agreed to a modest reduction in the threshold where students started to repay debt some time ago. We just think $45,000 is too low.
Now, just a couple of quick things to finish up. The ANU has withdrawn from its negotiations for a degree in Western Civilization, which would be sponsored by the Ramsey Centre. The university cited concerns about academic autonomy. Do you think it's made the right decision and should stick to it?
Look, I don't know the specific demands that the Ramsey people were making of the university. I certainly think academic freedom is absolutely vital, and I'd say it's a foundation of Western civilization itself. So I think it is important that universities retain the ability to set the course content and hire academics and so on. I wouldn't think that any donor to a university, whether it's a company or another country or a foundation like this, should be able to interfere in what's taught in universities. The only thing I would say is that it did seem like some of the objections from some quarters were to the teaching of Western civilization. I don't feel that it's a problem to be teaching about art and philosophy and democracy and liberation movements and so on. I don't think we can oversimplify what Western civilization is, though, and that means that if we're talking about Western civilization, if we're talking about, democracy is a terrific example. A lot of the people who are talking about the wonderful gift that democracy is, and it is a wonderful gift, you know, a few decades ago would have said that Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. So let's teach Western civilization in its complexity. Let's not try and simplify it in the way that some have suggested.
And just finally, an issue which is not a federal issue, but one that I think is of interest to a lot of people, and no doubt to you as a parent. The New South Wales government is looking at whether smartphones should be banned on school grounds. What do you think about this issue of over-connected kids? Have you found this a problem in your family?
Michelle, If someone had told me what buying an Xbox would do to our family, I would never have allowed it into the house.
Share.
Look, the kids... It is. The technology is addictive. There is absolutely no question in my mind that our kids are addicted to screens. And I don't just mean my three, I mean kids generally. So I think looking at measures to teach kids to reduce the amount of time that they're spending on screens and to use screens more responsibly is vital. We're not going to remove the iPhone from, you know, the teenage world.
But maybe from the classroom?
Absolutely from the classroom. I think kids leaving their phones in their lockers, you know, before and after school, being able to make sure you know where your kids are and communicate with them, make sure they're home safely if they're travelling home on their own, all of that. Parents value that, I think. In the classroom, I think they are largely a distraction. And when students of different ages are interacting with technology, there are some great learning programs. There are some really, there's great gamification of learning in some instances. But we need to teach them responsible use. We need to teach them to turn off sometimes and talk to one another.
Do you have any tips for the home scene?
No, I'm terrible. My biggest tip is have strict rules, not too many, enforce them strictly. So when we go on holidays, we always pick places that don't have, or we try and pick places that don't have internet connections, and we always make the kids leave their devices at home. So holidays are device-free, but then my husband and I have to be device-free too.
Could be no awkward devices when at the leader table. Rings.
Yes, well, my staff know where to find me. There's always a landline. But making sure that we have time, no devices at the table when we're eating meals, you know, a limited number of hours on the weekend, removing of screen privileges. If you've done something wrong, it's a pretty good incentive to behave well, I can tell you, the removal of the device. But it's tough, and I really do think parents, most of the parents I talk to, are struggling with this.
Tanya Plibersek, thank you very much for talking with us today, even if you sound a hard taskmaster at home.
Well, I think if you ask my children, they'd say I'm the cruelest mother in the universe when I take their screens away.
And that's all for today. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back again soon.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.